Welcome to the Reasoned Roundtable, your weekly jolt of libertarianism brought to you by the magazine Free Minds, Free Markets. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangyu Ward. Happy almost end of the year, comrades.
Happy New Year.
Hey, Matt.
Happy New Year.
So every year at this festive time, while everyone else is doing their various year-end lists, we like to engage in a little counter-programming here, as befits an alternative lifestyle, as reason tends to be, in the form of talking about some undercovered stories from the waning year. We are, as libertarians, perhaps attuned to some different frequencies than the average bear and detect importance in places where others yawn or don't see anything at all. So while other people talk about the insane and momentous 2024 presidential campaign, which is always worthy of discussion, most of the time, we're going to, on this episode, get into the margins and bring back items of importance. So we're going to cover three broad areas, basically America, the world, and private industry slash commerce slash science, whatever. Everybody here has done their homework. No one has shared their answers. So we're going to be just as surprised as the results as you are in Listenerville. So let's start, Catherine, with a category of U.S. politics and government for $300. What is an undercovered story of significance to libertarians and even other human beings that wasn't necessarily this presidential election? Go.
So California raised the wage for fast food workers to $20 an hour. And I just really don't think we're talking about that enough. That's bonkers. That's a crazy thing to do. California really just looked the world in the eye and said, like, maybe it's $20. Maybe it's $100 an hour. They are just testing the limits of mandating wage floors. And as goes California, so goes the nation, as we know. So it's important to talk about it. There were some immediate effects. The $20 an hour rate went into effect on April 1st, but was not a joke. And there were a bunch of, you know, there were a bunch of immediate effects and also a whole bunch of competing studies about whether, in fact, there were effects. Right. So this is it's going to be very muddy for a while. There are people who have really, really a lot invested on both sides of this question in showing that the results from this dramatic wage increase were exactly what they wanted them to be. But it does seem like there are some very specific takeaways, including a lot of automation. So El Pollo Loco has automated its salsa making. And if that is not the most important news in America, I don't know what is.
I recall back when I used to live in California at some point during one of the various crackdowns on illegal immigration. My wife, who was then a journalist, went out to the fields and like, well, what are you going to do without workers? And they started like building these elaborate robots, also staffed by illegal immigrants, to pick oranges. So elaborate robots of automation to get around California laws. Peter, I recall at some point, maybe I'm making this up, incepting it into my brain that minimum wage increases was right up there with like rent control as a near consensus economics profession thing. And then suddenly, like last 10, 15 years, people got wobbly, or am I just making that up?
Well, so that's the sort of classical economics consensus is that if you raise the wage floor, there will be costs to that. And then there were some studies that started coming out, I want to say around 2005, but I definitely could have my dates wrong, from Card and Autcher, who basically looked at fast food restaurants across the borders in two states, one of which had raised its minimum wage, the other of which had not. And they argued, actually, there's not really much of a cost to this based on that data. It was a really interesting study design, but it was also a flawed study design. And it was also a study design for wage hikes that were much smaller and starting from a much lower base than we're talking about right now. So it's a big argument about whether or not that study actually applies to all of these wage hikes where we're seeing minimum wage go from $7 or $10 to $15 or $20.
There's also been a bunch of debate amongst people about this, but everyone does seem to agree that it has made food more expensive in California. There's a debate about how much more expensive, but like 3.7% price increase since the new wages went into place seems, from what I can see, to be not controversial. So even if all of the other results are neutral or positive, there is still just like Americans spent this election signaling to politicians that they really, really care when regular stuff gets more expensive, and this makes regular stuff more expensive.
So my question on that, actually, with just a 3.7% increase, is how much of that is due to the minimum wage versus how much of that is just general food inflation? In particular, fast food is a lot of beef and chicken, right? And beef and chicken have just gotten much more expensive, independent of fast food wage laws all over the country.
Well, if you want to avoid meat in your fast food, you can always go to Taco Bell.
Classic.
That is true. Bell beefer all the way down. Nick, what is was your favorite minimum wage job? And then what do people get wrong when they talk or think about minimum wage? This has been a left-wing priority forever. Ralph Nader, all kinds of people, Bernie Sanders, like if we just hike this up, what do people miss when they talk about this stuff?
Well, you know, one on that last point, just on a big picture thing, if, you know, a $10 minimum wage is good and a $20 minimum wage is great, why not go to the $30 and make it super fantastic? And everybody understands that at some point, you know, mandating a wage for people who may or may not have the skills that where they produce enough to cover that wage is going to cause problems. And, you know, I think we need to hammer that home. The conventional wisdom or the received wisdom on the minimum wage started being challenged in the 90s, right around in the middle of the 90s, right as the economy was starting to take off and as Bill Clinton and the Democrats were pushing for for minimum wage hikes in a pretty big way. And so, you know, that timing is kind of like modern monetary theory. It's like we're going to do something and we need a theory to justify it. But I had many minimum wage jobs, Matt, and my favorite minimum wage job was working in a circuit board factory a couple days a week in my senior year of high school, where I was charged with various things, including cleaning circuit board. I don't even know how to describe it in less than about 6 hours, but in cleaning circuit boards that had been soldered with a solvent that would regularly make my hands stick together, where I would then have to use acetone and lava soap for about 40 minutes to clean them off so I could do that for another 30 minutes and then go back to that thing.
It's really too bad that you got that job too early to be subsidized by the CHIPS and Science Act.
Would have been nice. Would have been nice.
Nothing but facts. I would just add on all of that, that a root philosophical policy problem is that we spend too much time trying to make social policies by telling businesses what they should do. That's wrong. Stop it. All right. Peter, what is an undercovered story in American politics and governance from the year of our Lord 2024?
So a weird thing that happened this year was we had a presidential election, and that was weird enough on its own. But during that presidential election, we didn't talk very much about healthcare policy. I think Kamala Harris's position was basically, we'll do the same but more. And Trump's position was, I have concepts of a plan. So we just sort of left it at that. But that hasn't stopped healthcare policy from happening. And in March, the Biden administration issued new rules regarding short-term, limited-duration health insurance. The Medicare official release from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services when this happened said that the Biden-Harris administration is taking yet another action to lower healthcare costs and protect consumers from being scammed into purchasing lower quality insurance or, quote, junk insurance. So the reason the Biden administration prefers refers to these plans as junk insurance is that they're not very regulated. They're just not as regulated as the plans sold through Obamacare. That also makes those plans much less expensive. And this was basically a response to the Trump administration, which had issued its own rule through the White House in executive order, making those less regulated, less expensive plans available for up to a year and then renewable for up to 3 years so that you could get cheap coverage for a long time. Biden rule, however, said they can only last for about 3 months. Basically, what the Biden administration said was, if you like your cheap health insurance plan, you can't keep it, not for longer than 3 months anyway. And then they patted themselves on the back and basically said, look, these are junk plans. It's just a scam. But in fact, people like these plans. CBO has looked at them and said that they're not junk. They're not scammy. They work about as well as a comparable other healthcare plans in a lot of ways. And it's just it's really telling that this is the way that the Biden administration has chosen to pursue healthcare policy. And people aren't talking about it, but it's still going on. And the Biden administration chose to make health insurance to make cheap health insurance plans more expensive, less available.
Catherine, are you going to write a story called Why Junk Insurance is Good
Probably.
For You?
Probably. Sounds like something I would do.
Junk food and junk insurance.
Is there any chance, Peter, that the Republicans will actually repeal and replace anything in Obamacare?
You never know because you don't know what they think. This is the whole problem.
It has been the problem. That's
why they have concepts of a plan, is because they're still working on it. If you go back to the first Trump term and look at the 9 month or so effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act during that time, one of the big things that sticks out about all of the different plans and ideas that they had, and one of the reasons why they couldn't ultimately repeal Obamacare, is because they didn't really know what they wanted to replace it with. There were zero plans out there. It's not that there's no white papers or good ideas from think tanks. It's that there was absolutely no consensus amongst Republican legislators. And even the final bill, the one that John McCain in a late night vote famously thumbs down and killed, that final bill was basically, we're going to repeal Obamacare and come up with something else to replace it. And it was just like, the legislation was just like, well, the next thing we do is we have to come up with something. After they'd spent however many months trying to come up with something, after they had campaigned for the better part of a decade on trying to come up with something, and they still don't have anything more than concepts of a plan.
I, for one, think that we need to stop telling private companies what to do in order to pass our own social agenda. Decouple insurance from employment. Enough already. Nick, what is
good? Bad. Healthcare isn't it good like hamburgers or tacos or crunchy gorditas?
Hamburgers are my healthcare plan.
It's something that comes directly to your soul.
It has more meat than the bell beefer. Nick, what is a undercover American politics and governance story?
So I am going to go with the border crisis is over. The border crisis has been fueling, it was a major issue by some accounts, the major issue in the election, not just immigration per se, but people streaming over the border. In December of 2023, so roughly a year ago, 250,000 people were apprehended or had an encounter with Border Patrol. That is down to about 58,000 a month now.
That's more than zero.
It's more than zero, but it's also back to older historical trends going back several years. So. And that's a result of a number of things, one of which is the sender countries have changed a little bit. Things there are less bad. Mexico is actually stopping people. And Biden did start actually enforcing some rules that he had relaxed in his first 3 years in office. But, it's a big deal. And in places like New York City, Matt, migrants, right? We keep hearing about how these migrants are coming into the city and they're destroying it. There's been between, various sources, 200,000 to 250,000 since about 2021. In January of this year, 3,450 migrants applied for the programs that cover them in New York City. At the beginning of December, it was down to 500 a week. So these flows have significantly changed, but we are going to be making policy as if we are back at the peak of all of this kind of stuff, which will lead to mayhem and bad policy that is not even addressing the facts on the ground anymore.
I mean, but if Venezuela, which has coughed up 7 million refugees, and Haiti and a bunch of these other so-called shithole countries, Nick, if they keep producing refugees and we keep being here,
I'm not saying nobody's crossing the border. I'm just saying that these peak flows, we are back to, you know, to levels that we have not seen since before the pandemic and stuff like that. So it's like it's greatly reduced. That's what I'm saying. And to, you know, to act as if we are still under invasion, you know, in air quotes, is simply wrong. It's factually wrong. And it also helps explain why during the presidential election, the focus started shifting from the border to places like Springfield, Ohio, where, you know, a completely fake story that, you know, is, I mean, you know, is clued into deep emotional, atavistic, us versus them, you know, attitudes came out about Haitians who were here legally under temporary protected status eating neighborhood cats and dogs.
So my pick is related to migrants, I guess, in the sense that if there wasn't for the 200,000 migrants in New York City, I don't know who would be attending public schools anymore. We have passed peak public school in a way that hasn't really registered in people's minds. And I'm not talking about percentage numbers. I'm talking about raw numbers. The largest number of American children or people living in America that have gone to K through 12 was in 2019. It's just under 51 million. It is marching ever downward. It's projected to be 47 million in the year 2030. This is due to a variety of factors, including lower birth rates and some lower immigration. But it's also because people are fleeing public schools screaming. And if you factor in the number of people in charter schools, which are public in name, but they're not managed by the government, then the peak happened in 2012 already. And what this means for public policy is woefully underappreciated, which is to say that 20 to 25% of all tax money on the state and local level goes to K through 12 education. This is why you pay those property tax bills in many locations, including where I'm sitting. And you're paying for it for a free product that people are choosing not to use. And that gets more expensive to provide over and over again. And we're at the end of the cycle of around $200 billion that have been poofed into the system, maybe even more, depending on how you measure of it, from the federal government due to COVID-related policies or programs. So there's all these fiscal cliffs looming on the state and local level. There are a dozen states now that have pretty comprehensive school choice where the money can follow the kid into a private religious school if parents so desire. We haven't really, I don't think, grappled with the public policy implications and the tax revolt, frankly, that people are engaged in with their feet by moving from places like New York and Chicago to warmer climes that are managed a little bit better. And I predict that we're going to see a lot more politics that are associated with this as we go forward. All right, let's move on to global affairs, shall we? A lot of crazy stuff happening. It was Taiwan and the China and the North Koreans over with the Ukraines and everything. Nick, why don't you lead us off with a round of an underappreciated development in international affairs from this year?
I am going to talk about something that was documented in a book that came out very late in 2023 by a Brookings Institution scholar named Homi Karas. His book is called The Rise of the Global Middle Class, and he and various researchers with him have been talking about this for the better part of a decade. And in 2018, he actually announced that for the first time ever, a majority of people on the planet were at the middle class level or higher. And he defines middle class as being living on $10 to $100 or more in local purchasing power parity. The rise of the global middle class, which really kind of kicked into high gear this past year, once we get past all of the weird COVID deviations and stuff, is just something that we never hear about. We often will hear people talk about the decline in extreme poverty you know, over the past 25 years or things like that. But when you have a planet where more people are joining the middle class, they have discretionary income, they have more options, they tend to start both going to school more and demanding more, even more for their kids. It's a radical shift for everything, including domestic politics, but also geopolitics. And most of this growth is coming in the places that were formerly poor. So it's Africa, Latin America, parts of Asia. And it is, it's just something that we never talk about or kind of factor into what's going on when you look at places like Europe and North America, but we're going to have to. And it's, Nick, it's also a cause for celebration.
They might be middle class, but do they have meaning in their lives?
Well, this is the good question. No, this is actually, I mean, I talked about this in various ways, explicit and implicit. This is what's happening on the planet, is that we have mainstreamed existential angst. Because, you know, and I'm sure all of us within several generations of our families, you know, somebody did all the work so that the next generation could kind of sit around and actually wonder about what's it all mean. And when that goes global, that's a radically different world, literally, than anything we've ever seen in human history.
So it's the me decade all the way down in Latin America and Africa.
Look for whatever the new version of disco dancing in Ulaanbaatar, Matt. It's going to be crazy and it's going to be great.
They can afford to upgrade their McDonald's combo to a large fry, but they're sad.
Yeah.
That's pretty great. Peter, what's a global thing that happened this year that we're not talking about?
So they have healthcare in other countries, it turns out.
God, yep. I can't stop.
Including Britain, but only sort of, is the problem for them, because in September, there was this report that it's not that you can't find coverage of it, but there was this absolutely damning report on the state of the British healthcare system that said, in so many words, that it is in truly dire shape, that it's incredibly dysfunctional in basically every way, and that it is letting people die unnecessarily. So the first point in the official summary of the report was that the system was in, quote, serious trouble. That's point number one. And it just went on to detail all the ways the system was failing, in particular with really long wait times that are causing at emergency rooms that are estimated to cause 14,000 deaths per year. So if you're mad at American health insurance companies, you should also be pretty mad at the NHS and the bureaucrats that are running it. Now,
are you supporting
murder? I'm saying that if you find what American healthcare companies are doing to be upsetting, go look at the places that have government-run healthcare, in particular Britain and Canada, and see how it works there. It's also like that; it's killing people.
It's always those two.
Yeah, it is it? Always those two.
It's and always
in fact,
Britain
we read
and Canada. It doesn't. Does Switzerland not
exist,
sir?
Switzerland, Germany, some of these other places that have
what about
that have somewhat more.
I've heard about it, but I've never seen it.
That have more regulated systems rather than just sort of government-run systems, you know, run directly by the government. They're doing somewhat better, but these fully government-run systems are just absolute calamities. And so one of the interesting things about this report is that it was authored by somebody who was a former Labour Party member, a doctor who had worked in the NHS for 30 years, and somebody who really likes it and actually thinks that should be good and wants to make it better. And so libertarians might like some of the conclusions or nod their heads along with like, yeah, of course it's failing. But they're not going to necessarily like some of the diagnoses, which basically the report says that the NHS is extremely underfunded. And also it blames a 2012, I believe, reorganization by the Conservative Party that the report says, well, it was just really dysfunctional. It didn't actually care about how the system worked and it didn't work very well, has made the whole thing work less well, especially in the context of underfunding. But I would urge those who are here in America who want a more government-centric system to think about this in the context of our current political moment. If you are on the left, or I don't know, even some sort of radical fringe person who doesn't think of yourself that way, if you are someone who wants a more government-funded, more government-controlled healthcare system here in the United States, then what that means is you want a system where the funding and the management of that system are controlled by politics, which right now would mean a system controlled by Republicans and by Donald Trump. I do not think that that would produce the results that you want out of this. And in fact, because the UK system is controlled by politics and has become a political football, that is one of the reasons that it is dysfunctional.
Catherine, tell us about foreigners.
You know, what's kind of interesting is what's going on in El Salvador. And I think that we haven't talked about that enough. Reason has covered it, and I recommend to anyone who is interested in this to read the writings of Katerina Hall, who has visited, who has been covering what's going on. But Bukele is a very interesting character. He, you know, has attracted some attention in the libertarian circles for being a president of a real, if small, country that adopted Bitcoin as a legal tender in the country. That's kind of a big deal. And financially, this has worked out well for him in the sense of the government is holding a lot of Bitcoin right now. And so I don't know if y'all know, Bitcoin's doing pretty well right now. So that has helped El Salvador's bottom line in pretty interesting ways. It has not worked out in terms of actually using the stuff to do business day to day in the country. And there's a great piece from Katerina where she goes to El Salvador and tries to use Bitcoin to buy stuff and fails and fails and fails and fails and fails. And people treat her like she is bonkers to even be suggesting it. It's just a fascinating case study in the implementation of Bitcoin as, you know, as it interfaces with the state and also as it is used in kind of in everyday life. That is all happening on the backdrop of the fact that this dude is also an authoritarian monster. And that is also fascinating. He has overseen a massive crackdown on gang members that has been largely popular in the country, but has created a civil liberties nightmare. Something like 2% of the country is in jail right now.
Wow, sounds like America.
Right. So that's what I do. 2% of El Salvador's adult population has been detained. Sorry, not in jail right now. And at least 18.
Am I being detained?
18 people.
Am I being detained?
I'm talking about death and horror, Suderman. 18 people have died in police custody. And it's always worth remembering that the U.S. caused the gang problem, or at least seriously contributed to causing the gang problem in El Salvador. Why? Oh, it was when we deported a whole bunch of people there from here. We're about to do that again, potentially. So I think that that's really worth keeping an eye on. And finally, I will just say there's also been a crackdown on the press and generally on free speech. They just moved toward a right to be forgotten law that will be used probably against enemies of the state. It's a fascinating story, and it's a small country, and it hasn't gotten as much attention as you might imagine, but it deserves more.
Quick follow-up. If we got bad gang people from El Salvador, why shouldn't we?
So this is...
Catherine.
So the question is basically, like, were they bad gang people to start out with? We don't know. Like, and also how much of their decision to become bad gang people, which, by the way, is not a moral status, was due to the American-led war on drugs, right? So we just had this, like, very, very complicated system where a reason that you might move back and forth between the U.S. and El Salvador does have to do with the drug trade, either because you are a part of it or because you are fleeing it. And the kind of permeability between those two categories is more than you would think.
How is Malay's crypto chops down there in Argentina?
I don't really know the answer to that well enough to answer it on a national podcast.
Okay. This is an international
podcast. Good point.
Please. And
speaking
of which, I'm going
to talk.
Borders
can't hold this podcast in.
Correct. Barnes & Noble can, though. I'm going to talk about Catherine Mangu Ward's ancestral homelands in southeastern Europe, bordering the Black Sea. There's been a bunch of, like, nails on chalkboard news coming out of first Moldova and then Romania, which is where Catherine's people derive from, over the last couple of months. Those countries border Ukraine. They are on the Black Sea. The Russian Navy is not far away. They are poor, generally speaking. Moldova is one of the most, if not the most, poor country outside of Belarus in Europe. And Romania has always had its own problems. They're both riddled with corruption, and they both have had elections in which Russia has been monkeying around to large degrees, although that is, of course, disputed by Russia and other people. First, Moldova, which had has an interesting president, Maria Sandu. I'm sure I'm botching her name, was elected. I wrote about her in the magazine a couple of years ago, basically, you know, saying if anyone can turn around a Moldova, or if Moldova can be turned around, then then it's possible anywhere. Such was the misery of the place. They had a referendum in October about whether they want to join the EU, and Russia is alleged to have tried to buy 300,000 votes in that election, in that referendum. It passed by less than a percentage point, like 50.3 to 49.6, something like that. And that was coincidental with a Sandu running for re-election. She won a little bit more handily. The European Union described what Russia, nearby Russia, did as unprecedented malign interference into this election. And Russia said that the election was neither democratic nor fair. This is all part of the post-1991, when Soviet Union fell apart. Russia trying to have influence in what it's called its near abroad, former holdings. Moldova used to be part of the Soviet Union, no longer is. There is ethnic and linguistic Russian minorities there. And so very similarly to places like Georgia, Russia has at various times intervened militarily or backed people to be separatists there. Romania, which is a member of EU and NATO, so it's a little bit more direct skin in the game when it comes to the United States of America. They had a presidential election in November. That was a first round of an election that was surprisingly close between one dude and then another dude who was backed by Russia. The Constitutional Court in early December looked at that and said, we're just going to annul it. We're going to annul this election because we are going to claim, based on like some secret session, that Russia tried to influence it too much. And so we're going to reschedule it. This is dicey stuff that is happening right now. Russia has an interest in making its sort of western flank filled with places that are more like Hungary under Viktor Orban, Russia friendly, skeptical of the EU, skeptical of NATO, and wishing to see the Ukraine war no longer supported by the West. This is the area I've thought ever since the first minute of the Ukraine war, Moldova especially, would be the most likely next place for Russia to be involved militarily. It's very close to Odessa. Everyone's always pointing at Poland as being the next place. Poland would fight back to a degree that Moldova and even Romania just cannot. So it's a definite flashpoint in Europe going forward, those places. Also, in my mind, speaks to why you shouldn't hurry on integration into places like NATO and the European Union if countries are not in that moment ready to join, which I don't think Moldova is anytime soon, certainly with NATO, but also with the EU. All right, we're going to move on to the private industry commerce / science / whatever. What are the humans doing outside of government that are of particular interest in this year? Peter, why don't you lead us off with a round of what the privates are doing?
So just
no.
Wow.
No. No.
Okay. Phrasing. So phrasing. I was going to say that I feel like unprecedented malign influence is actually my role on the podcast, but maybe that's we're jointly participating in
yes,
that.
You are.
So the thing that that I think we're not talking about enough is that Google has made a major breakthrough in quantum computing, and it said it figured out how to do some crazy test calculation that that would take a normal supercomputer, which I guess is not normal because that makes it super, right? But a normal supercomputer would take longer than the current age of the universe to complete. So that's kind of a big deal. But the really strange thing about this that is like the subcurrent of discussion here is the guy who's at Google who like worked on this, who wrote it up for the Google blog or whatever, was like, we're pretty sure that this proves the existence of the multiverse. The multiverse, like what the MCU has been experimenting with for the last decade. Yeah, I'm sorry, the Marvel Cinematic Universe that everybody hates, right? But for real. The multiverse, and it really, it's kind of like, this is apparently how they think this calculation is being run, is that instead of doing the calculations in order, in sequence, like a normal computer would, it is taking advantage of the other strands of the multiverse to run calculations in parallel. This is crazy. I don't understand this. I am not enough of a physicist or a computer scientist to really grok how these qubits work. But just think about what that means here. It means that the Marvel Cinematic Universe is true, for one thing. It also, but it also, like, this is just going to open up all sorts of weird cans of worms. Like, think about this, applying this to politics. If we can do multiversal calculations and do stuff in the multiverse that is reaching across the boundaries of our universe and into others, then maybe we can start to do statistical analysis of elections that actually has enough data. Because, right, that's what's happening in the multiverse, is all possible elections are happening at once. And so you could just, instead of having only however many samples, right, like instead of having an incredibly small sample size of just a few elections, just a handful of them over the course of 200 something years, we would have an infinite number of elections and we could actually just run the simulation, except it would be real, right? It would be real. And Nate Silver could just tell us.
It'd be a simulation.
No, it wouldn't be, because Peter, it's actually happening in another universe.
Peter, can I just ask?
Matt,
can I ask
think
this
of
in
the possibilities for Stratomatic baseball?
I'm looking at my Stratomatic set right now.
Can they I ask this in Suderman speak? Yeah. So we would all be Doctor Strange at the end of Avengers Endgame.
We would all be Doctor Strange at the end of Avengers Endgame, but maybe also Doctor Who. Every time he goes into his little telephone booth that he can fit like a whole spaceship in? I don't know. So the other thing you have to wonder, if we're doing multiverse calculations in other multiverses, what are other multiverses doing in our universe?
Dun, dun, dun.
Flying drones. Yeah. Flying drones over New
Jersey. Not an undercover story.
They're bringing hamburgers to Chris Christie, as Donald Trump pointed out in a widely circulated tweet.
Are they bringing
totally befitting of the President of the United States.
Are they bringing them from California at very high
cost? An hour.
This is what's going to happen. Here. The future is drone delivery of fast food from low minimum wage states near California across the border.
Yeah, that might be true.
Catherine, do you have any idea what Peter was just
talking about? I think I do, which means I must be wrong.
The best thing about this supercomputer is that it's called Willow, and you wonder whether that's because of the Joss Whedon show, the Buffy the Vampire Slayer character, or whether it's because of the late 1980s Ron Howard George Lucas fantasy film with Val Kilmer.
Those are the two choices.
You were saying, Catherine?
Seems cool. I'm into it.
Yeah, all but right. Are all of the Catherines into it in every strand
every
of the multiverse?
Every single one.
It sounds like a bunch of gobbledygook. Yeah. As Norm MacDonald would say. Catherine, what is your entrance for the private thing? I don't think you can say rockets.
I'm not going to say rockets.
I don't think you're allowed.
I actually considered and then decided that it would be too much to say rockets. So instead, I am going to say HIV drugs, because pretty big stuff happening this year. There is a new injectable long-acting HIV medication, which is preventative. It prevents things.
Nope.
Lenacapavir, which is sort of would function similarly to PrEP, to the pre-exposure prophylaxis pills or injections that many people take. But you only have to get a shot once or maybe twice a year. They're still trying to figure that out. And it really, 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 really works. It works spectacularly well to prevent people from getting HIV in the first place. This is huge. This is a huge deal. It's so effective that there was a recent trial in on women in Uganda and South Africa that worked so well that they halted it early, which is always a good sign. And there are trials going on in Argentina, in Brazil, in Mexico, in Peru, and here in the United States. It's Gilead Sciences. It's just a big bad pharma company out here ending one of the most horrific medical scourges of our time. So great work, humanity.
Nice job. Nick, what's the thing that...
I hesitate to extend any of this podcast, but Catherine, have they picked out a completely stupid brand name yet in America?
It does have a brand name. I forget what it is, and it's a meaningless jumble of letters per use.
Okay.
Hargaville.
That's not bad.
At least it's not the insulin pump that is connected to your iPhone, which is called the Omnipod.
Oh, yeah. That sounds good. Why?
That sounds awesome.
Two words.
It's an awesome thing. Yeah. It's just a terrible
Sunlenka.
Terrible name. Oh, okay.
Yeah, that just sounds like something you put on your kale salad.
Sounds like an alternative artist from Zambia in the late 80s.
Or maybe like an oil that's not a seed oil. Yeah. Yeah.
Give us a report from Planet Industry and Commerce.
Okay, so what I think has been uncovered, undercovered, but not covered, is the rise of Bitcoin to normalcy. You know, we have at the end of this year, we've seen it go to historic highs, which is amazing in and of itself because it's been declared dead, you know, multiple times in its decade plus long existence. But what I'm particularly talking about is when early in the year, I guess it was in January, BlackRock and Fidelity and a couple of other investment companies started offering ETFs or, you know, essentially mutual funds where you can buy in. Not only can you buy into Bitcoin and other forms of crypto, but I think Bitcoin is more important here. That they were also recommending to their clients, like BlackRock was apparently telling its salesmen that you should be recommending that everybody hold at least 2% of their investments in Bitcoin. And this is amazing because Bitcoin now is already one of the most traded currencies or one of the biggest stores of value on the planet. And it has triggered a series of political adaptations. There's people like Cynthia Lummis, who's a senator from Wyoming, who, you know, just 3 years ago, I think I interviewed her and she was talking about she had founded a crypto caucus or a Bitcoin caucus in Congress, trying to explain the very basics of Bitcoin and crypto to her peers there. She is now likely to be able to pull off a strategic Bitcoin reserve, which would be funded by, you know, dollars. I mean, it would be the federal government be using it kind of the way that they've used gold reserves as a hedge against inflation and a store of value and things like that. You know, it's just amazing. And this is the type of thing when the future actually happens, we've kind of already moved on. So I think that, you know, that rise of Bitcoin to normalcy, it's not yet and probably never will be a payment system for everyday purchases, which is what Satoshi Nakamoto actually envisioned it as. But it is here to stay in a big, big way. You know, and obviously Bukele in El Salvador, and I think he announced, you know, that he was going to make it acceptable for legal tender, I believe 3 years ago as well. But this is different. It is now part of the furniture, and we should be recognizing that more and also kind of figuring out how that's going to change the equation, both in the private sector as well as the public sector.
So when do we get our Ocean's 11 style movie about a group of ragtag thieves who are trying to steal the strategic Bitcoin reserve?
That, you know, it's happened. There have been a bunch of major Bitcoin heists over the years from banks.
Should we bring it all together? It's actually somebody who wants to do a heist to steal the cold wallet holding the El Salvadorian Bitcoin
That works for me.
Yeah.
It's because he's mad he's not rich enough to afford a hamburger in California.
United States, went to Caltech, then got kicked out by Donald Trump, went back to El Salvador and became the treasurer of MS-13.
Yep. Would watch.
Yep. Would watch. So my entrance for this is a confession of Stockholm syndrome. Having a 16-year-old daughter who, even in the duration of this podcast, is sending me the worst
possible TikToks.
This is
dramatically undercovered, Matt. I got to tell you, none of the major news outlets have talked about your Stockholm syndrome.
That is correct. No, but it's the lingo of the kids. This whole entire universe of Rizzlers and Skibbities in Ohio and toilets and gooning and yacht and Haktua, and all of the songs that are made with just only those teen lingo vocabulary words. I haven't seen anything like this since like California surfer culture, skateboard culture of the 70s and 80s of just pure concentrated action at inventing nonsense words all of the time. And then attempting to speak that language so much now that it's appearing in Walmart commercials of moms trying to figure out their kids on the school bus. It's all terrible for the most part, but it's also very creative and interesting. And it's nice to see that in the midst of the John Haidt nightmare that we live in, where all the teens are on their phones and therefore death, that there is some creativity being done, including my daughter and her friend doing the Baron Trump, I like my suitcase thing on a video just yesterday. But it's the vocabulary creation in particular, which I think is pretty interesting. It's not purely undercover. I think some of these are like word of the year of whatever annoying online dictionary exists in the world. But the sheer volume of it and the delight taken in speaking only in this nonsense lingo terms is kind of interesting. And I don't think appreciated on its own for an act of creative something. I don't know.
Can I ask, Matt, do you think it is, are people worried about it? Or are people completely oblivious to it? Because, you know, when texting became a thing back when we had the flip phones, what's the name of that thing? You know, the program where you have to go through each letter, like ABC.
SMS.
What's that?
SMS, the texting protocol?
No, I mean, that's the texting program. But the way the keys on the old flip phones were, it led to people using shorthand and phonetic spelling. And there was a huge outcry, which we actually talked about in a couple articles at Reason, where people were like, texting is destroying the English language. And this time around, Matt, I don't see that. I think it seems like we're more
like a man who is not hanging out in teen adjacent circles. Like, I would say approximately 23% of the conversations I have with other parents are, is this a beautiful like fluorescence of new vocabulary, or are our children gibbering idiots and we're not sure.
It's a coin flip.
Yeah. I was told the other day that I had W Riz, and it was a real highlight of my day. So that's where I'm at.
Can someone explain the Ohio thing to me?
Nope.
Okay.
Whatever you do, by the way, don't buy the Haktua girl shit coin. To go back to, you know, that's part of the downside.
Just like, sometimes do you hear the sentences that we say, and it's like, wow, whatever you do. Don't buy the Haktua girl shitcoin.
Maybe there is a multiverse
where
in
she
which
is
El Salvador's the richest person in which El Salvador's entire economy is based on the Haktua shitcoin.
I'm off to go disco dancing in Ulaanbaatar. This is my solution.
I want to die all over again. But since I started talking about culture, let's end with our traditional, what we have been consuming. So we're looking for pieces of culture that came out in the year 2024 that are, that came under the radar, underappreciated, and yet of interest, at least to those of us who follow closely the travails of Hawktua shitcoins in El Salvador. Nick, why don't you start us off?
I am going to talk about the podcast Disgraceland, which is actually has been around since 2018, and it is hosted and written and produced by Jake Brennan. It is a mash of true crime and true rock stories, and it is one of the big delights I notice in my I listen to stuff on Spotify, and it was my number two podcast in terms of minutes listened to this year. You know, he has in his archive, most of which is available for free, but you can also join and get, you know, whatever. He has a great two-part episode about the Beach Boys and Charles Manson and just their horrible, like how the Manson family was the most functional part of the Beach Boys family. He's got a two-parter about John Lennon and more specifically really about Mark David Chapman, but he talks about John Lennon's politics in the 70s. He's got a great episode that came out this year about Bob Dylan in his, you know, when he was going from Bringing It All Back Home to Highway 61 Revisited to Blonde on Blonde and just becoming an amphetamine freak. And he recreates what's going on in these people's lives and world. A fantastic episode about Mariah Carey that just dropped that will make everybody sympathetic to Mariah Carey, which is a rare thing. So it's a virtuoso performance. And he is constantly talking about how rock and roll is over. It was a historical moment, but we would do well as a society to keep the flame of rock and roll alive. So Disgraceland is the thing that made 2024 a little bit more easy to tolerate.
One of the things that I like about that genre, and I haven't listened to Disgraceland, but I'm going to, but like Cocaine and Rhinestones was another podcast that's like that. The writing of Stephen Hayden, who's my favorite going rock critic, is very much like that. An appreciation of music, and especially rock music, rap music, popular music, post-war, like super warts and all. It's the warts that we like. It is all of the
and they are normally venereal warts, just to be clear.
Yes, definitely.
Now, what
like
he is part of, Jake Brennan is part of, I think, is a super fan phenomena that I think started in a big way with ESPN, but where you love something, but you also like to make fun of it. And it's not like you can treat it ironically or recognize its vulgarity and stupidity and criminality and amorality or immorality and still be like, you know what, this fucking stuff, you know, it rocks. So
I feel like I should just go next because that's what I'm talking about is someone who's very much like this. One of my favorite records of the year, you've never heard of it. It's called The Cleansing by Peter Parrett, P-E-R-R-E-T-T. He used to be the lead singer of The Only Ones, which was a Brit, like punk band. Late 70s, early 80s. They even toured, opened up for The Who before they imploded. Peter Parrett is 72 years old, started making solo records about 7 years ago. Why not? Like, get in the game. He is just a miserable old junkie. And his album is fantastic. It's a double album at age 72 called The Cleansing and has songs like My Secret Taliban Wife. It just, the whole thing is like a horrible crust punk flipping off the universe about the possibility that he or anyone else might die unless it's all of his enemies in which he's going to dance in your grave. It's great. And it just sounds like great rock kind of Brit punk music, incorrigible and just will give you a jolt in your veins. So check it out. Peter Parrott, The Cleansing. Available in your streaming categories or whatever nearby. Catherine, what did you consume or what is an undercovered bit?
So this was, in fact, a global viral sensation, but I think it was undercovered in our world. So I want to put in a bid for Mudang the Hippo. This is a pygmy hippo who was born in, I think, July in Thailand. And just like the most outstanding, small, shiny little hippopotamus you can imagine. And the reason that I think people in our world need to know more about Mu Deng is because she became associated with, for her spicy behavior, the slogan "Become Ungovernable." And there are T-shirts. There are, you can get embroidery projects to hang on your wall on Etsy. Just anything you could imagine with the picture of this very cute hippo and the words "Become Ungovernable." And I think that that is, as we said at some point, I don't know, 5 years ago, a big mood that we should all be embracing as we go into 2025. Mu Deng, the pygmy hippo. I am a longtime fan of hippos, and this may be the best hippo of my lifetime so far.
Aren't hippos like the most murderous animals for us humans?
So people love that fact. And it is true that the land speed of a full-size hippo is terrifying, and they will kill you. This is a pygmy hippo. So these are small.
Okay. They're friendly.
They're not friendly. That's the whole point of Mu Deng.
Do they purr?
She does not give a shit. She is not friendly. She is adored by billions, and she is not friendly. And I love that for her and for us.
Peter, a little bit quickly, if you will, what is an undercovered piece of culture from the year 2024?
You missed an opportunity for a great transition there. All right, Mu Deng along.
No.
Yep. So we have covered it a lot on this podcast, at Reason Magazine and on this podcast, but Rebel Ridge, the civil asset forfeiture revenge film. People aren't talking enough about how awesome it is. I've watched this movie, I think, 3 times now, and I love it. I love it in like just like as a movie, but also as an idea, as like the way that this takes a slightly complicated public policy issue and turns it basically into Rambo with Don freaking Johnson in what is essentially the Brian Dennehy role from the original Rambo, you know, a sympathetic vet who shows up in a small town, gets in a fight with the local cops. They try to steal his stuff using a legal procedure. And we publish stories about civil asset forfeiture all the time at Reason. And usually the end of that story is, and IJ is like involved in a lawsuit. And often IJ wins because IJ is very good at what they do. But what if instead of the end of that story being IJ takes these people to court and eventually wins like 3 years later, what if the end of that story was, and this guy with a very special set of skills just goes and rampages his way through the police department non-lethally? And that's another part of what makes this really awesome is the action is fantastic, but it's about a guy who's going out of his way not to kill the cops. He is instead using all of the ill-gotten weapons that they have bought with their civil asset forfeiture funds to do crowd control. All of the stuff that is designed not to kill people, just to kind of really hurt them and throw them for a loop. And he's like, what if we took that and turned it back on the cops? It's awesome. It's perfectly structured. It's just such a great little tight, taut action film. And it's also one of the most sort of straightforwardly Reason-style libertarian movies I have ever seen.
All right. Thank you all for listening to the Undercovered Stories of 2024. Have a unsafe and insane New Year's Eve. Go to our reason.com/podcast for those things. /events for those things, /donate for that thing. And otherwise, we shall see you in 2025. Goodbye.